Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by William Dwyer Joyce, also known as DJ. DJ is a peer support worker with lived experience of disordered eating. DJ works to support those with eating disorder recovery, having been there himself. DJ also works to educate people and challenge the stereotypes of what a person with an eating disorder may look like. In this week's episode, we speak all about DJ's experience of having binge eating disorder. We also speak about his experience of ADHD and addiction. So I really hope that you enjoy this episode, and I really enjoyed it and understanding the different ways that the things that DJ has experienced have interconnected with each other and now how he uses that to support other people. Well, DJ, it is so nice to have you on the podcast. It's funny, I mean, I feel like I say this at the start of every single episode, but I feel like we connected ages ago and then life happens, but here we are now.
I know, yeah, it took a few reschedulings, but here we are.
It's the classic. It's life just gets so busy, doesn't it? And then, so glad to be chatting now.
Yeah, no, it's thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me. Did you want to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Yeah, sure. So, hi, my name's William Dwyer Joyce, based in Dublin. I go by DJ in work. I go by DJ just generally, but also in work. I'm a peer support worker at Lois Bridges Eating Disorder Centre in Dublin. For those who don't know what that is, I guess I'm an other words for it are peer specialist or expert by experience, lived experience specialist. So basically I use my lived experience of mental health or mental ill health recovery and to support others and on their journey of recovery. I guess where I work specifically is in eating disorders, but peer support deals with a whole range of things. And so I guess what that looks like day to day is I meet people once a week, kind of one-to-one sessions. I also facilitate groups, and I am part of the MDT team meetings, also just kind of generally around for chats and stuff. So in those bridges, we have inpatient, we have a day program, and we have outpatient, and I work a little bit with everyone. And so that's me.
Amazing. Well, I think it's so nice. I've had a couple of conversations with people lately about peer support and the role of lived experience. And it's lovely, I think, not lovely. Lovely sounds like a bit too flouncy for it, but it's so important that lived experience is being brought in. So I'm really happy to hear that that is your role and that's what you do. And I wondered, maybe before we get started in talking about your role within peer support, if you wouldn't mind talking to us a little bit about your lived experience.
Yes, absolutely. So from an early age, I have used food as a way to cope with difficult emotions. Later on, obviously, I got a diagnosis of binge eating disorder. I know I'm talking about lived experience, but just to kind of bring it back a little bit. I mean, it's funny now because within peer support, I mean, I try not to talk about specific diagnoses just because I suppose peer support is just really about dealing with mental distress in a, I guess, a non-medicalized way. And diagnosis can pigeonhole people and make people feel that, you know, they have to be a certain way or they're wrong if they're not a certain way or whatever. But yeah, I suppose that was my experience for a very long time. I also have a diagnosis of ADHD and feel kind of similarly complicated feelings about that in terms of the world of diagnosis and what that means for my identity and stuff. Yeah, I guess I've always kind of struggled with things like impulse control and, you know, feeling emotions really strongly and, you know, sort of feeling like I often need some kind of escape or numbing from my body. That led to, I guess, a lot of mental distress and feeling quite frustrated with my life and sad at times and angry and just, I suppose, using coping mechanisms that weren't serving me. You know, just, I guess, to talk a little bit about the body image aspect, I suppose I've been plus size all my life, or all my remembered life. And that's been quite challenging in terms of, you know, the shame and guilt that I feel, particularly in terms of having an eating disorder and what that means and stuff, not neatly fitting into eating disorder stereotype. You know, the stereotype of the kind of 18 to 25 year old female with anorexia, and like that is what the main sort of idea of what eating disorders are in the kind of ethos and world out there. But, you know, we know that's, you know, there's a whole range of genders, socioeconomic backgrounds, ethnicities, sexualities, gender identity, you know, the whole gamut of people, you know, deal with sort of eating issues and disconnection from eating. It took me a long time to get a binge eating diagnosis. I was in mental health services for a long time before I just happened to be sat in front of the right psychologist who was like, I think food is actually at the center of this. And then in around 2016 is the first time I came to Lewis Bridges, which I did a residential admission for an eating disorder. I'd done residential treatments in like big, you know, sort of the bigger hospitals for just kind of like general anxiety or whatever. And like, I suppose that got me safe, but it didn't really deal with the kind of the problems I was having. And I guess when I came to Lewis Bridges, it was really just about, for me, accepting that I had an eating disorder, that it wasn't just willpower, that I didn't just need to eat less, that it wasn't just, you know, one of the many diets I was cycling through that was going to save me, you know. I mean, I guess I also had substance use issues as well. And, you know, that took a long time to figure itself out as well. You know, I'm sober now 5 years and about a month. And it's been a long journey, but now I've gotten to a place where I feel, I suppose, I don't want to, certainly solid in my recovery. I still have bad days. I still, you know, recovery isn't linear. You know, it's, I know it's almost like a cliche at this point, but, you know, I have good days, I have bad days, like everyone does. But I find my job like super motivating for my own recovery. I love, you know, hearing, I love meeting people. I love hearing their experience. You know, because I learned so much from it as well. That's what I love about peer support. It's like the mutuality aspect, and it's not just me like disseminating help to you. It's like, you know, a shared, you know, collaborative process. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the biggest reasons I love the podcast, is because I get to speak to so many different people and get insights of their experience. And, you know, this time 2 years, 18 months ago, I was in a relapse, and a lot of people said to me, like, should you be doing the podcast? Is that good for you? And I was like, I'm being very open about the fact that I'm in a relapse, and actually coming on and speaking to people, it really helped with that. Mm-hmm. One question I wanted to ask you was, I completely resonate with what you were saying about the whole diagnosis thing.
Yeah.
And I was actually like thinking about it the other day in terms of the pros and cons of diagnoses.
Yeah.
Because I think that there are both.
Absolutely.
I just wondered from your perspective, you know, the diagnoses that you've received, whether it's binge eating disorder, ADHD, there might be different pros and cons for each of those. I wondered what your experience had been with that.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, I spent many years sort of, I guess, really believing in that kind of, I guess, medicalized model of mental health, you know. Like, you know, I was diagnosed with ADHD at 18, like just after I'd finished my sort of Irish state exams. And I had a lot of challenges in school. And, you know, I really thought that I was just like lazy or stupid or whatever. Like I was constantly in trouble for not having work done and, you know, didn't do very well in my exams. And then, you know, at 18, I got this diagnosis and it was like, okay, well, like now I feel like there's not something wrong with me, you know, and that this is, you know, something that's like, it's just a neurological difference and that's okay. And then, you know, I had generalized anxiety diagnosis and I had a BPD diagnosis, which is now UPD, you know, and, depression and then, you know, an eating disorder and stuff. And I suppose, again, it's like, it's exactly what you said. There's 100% pros and cons. I think when you get a diagnosis, certainly for me, the first thing you think is like, okay, I'm normal. There's a need for this to be like a category that enough people experience it, that I'm not like absolutely insane. You know, I'm not on my own. And also, you know, when you get a diagnosis, you know, you think, well, there must be a treatment for this as well. You know, there must be a way out. And I suppose, though, for me, what I found was because I spent many years in addiction, I spent many years very ingrained in my behaviors, and that the diagnosis for me kind of changed from now I have a treatment plan and a way out of this to I'm fighting against something that I can't change, you know? That like, because I have an eating disorder or because I have ADHD, I believe all of these like things about myself, you know, that are not movable. And, you know, I spent many years kind of, you know, using different mental health services, kind of like a revolving door, feeling like I need help, you know, that it sort of took away an element of autonomy from me, that, you know, I felt that I was someone who couldn't do things on my own, that I needed external help to like move forward. Like you said, it's pros and cons. And I think that, you know, particularly because of the work I do is specialized, I specifically work with people with eating disorders because I do think that experience is quite specific. But I don't know, it's complicated.
It's so individualized to everybody, I think. And yeah, you know, in my experience, and I think, and you may resonate with this as well, you may not, but the diagnosis of an eating disorder, I found, okay, this, as you so nicely put, this means there's a treatment for me.
Yeah.
It's almost validating in terms of, okay, now I've got this diagnosis, like almost in a way like I've met the criteria for it. I deserve help in a bad way. But I guess then it's kind of, you know, particularly, I mean, I'm making a massive assumption here, so I'm just going to refer to my own experience. But because my eating disorder wasn't the classic anorexia, the treatment then actually wasn't appropriate for me. So it was then kind of like the relief, but then a big kick in the face. And then also holding on to that label of the eating disorder and that becoming my identity. Yeah. In contrast to that, with the ADHD, it was a relief. Yes. Actually, I don't think I mean in contrast, but I guess more what I mean is the diagnosis with an eating disorder gave me something that I needed to recover from, whereas the diagnosis with ADHD was like, oh my God, what a relief. It felt like a ton of bricks taken off my back.
Yeah.
And it kind of explained so much and allowed me to connect with community. However, I think with an eating disorder, it can allow you to connect with community and build identity, but that's not sometimes the best thing.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think even just in terms of, I think, you know, when, how do I put this? I relate to what you're saying in the sense that like I very much formed an identity around being sick. And I think that kept me stuck for many years because it's like, well, if I'm not sick and if I'm not someone who needs help and if I'm not, you know, I guess like a sympathetic character or someone who needs to be taken care of, if I get well, am I not going to be taken care of? Am I not going to be special or different to others, you know? And that can be really, really challenging to break, you know, because I mean, suppose I found with recovery that like each leap you take, each leap of faith, each time the leap gets a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it can be really hard to, I guess, see that progress when maybe, you know, you're feeling better, but maybe the behaviors haven't necessarily fully stopped, you know, and still feeling like very much you're in that identity and stuff. I don't know if I'm making sense, but I feel like...
No, I completely understand.
Yeah. That like, yeah, I think because yes, you know, and I suppose that as well is like, I don't know if you relate to this, but you know, if you kind of work in this kind of podcasting area where you're talking about these things a lot, and I know in my work, you know, I specifically work with people with eating disorders, like a lot of the things I read are around recovery and eating disorders and mental health and peer support. And, you know, I go online and you follow loads of people who are like, you know, like recovery things and like eating disorder things. And like, sometimes I really have to step back and be like, I am actually like a full person. I'm a partner. I'm a son. I like music. Yeah. I like writing. You know, it can be a lot. And even within recovery, that my identity isn't surrounded by it because I'm so much more than just a diagnosis or someone in recovery or, you know, yeah.
And I think that's even the case. It's interesting because last week on the podcast, I spoke to Fee Hollings, who she mm-hmm. has autism and had anorexia. And, yeah. you know, we were talking about a bit about diagnoses there as well. And we were talking about how, mm-hmm. you know, when you've got eating disorder and neurodiversity, an eating disorder is something that you're trying to recover from, whereas neurodiversity is part of you, but it's something that you're trying to, like, you know, increase the strengths and, you know, manage yes. the challenges. And I think that is definitely right. And I think sometimes because of that, like ADHD is a part of me. That's a really key phrase, is that it's a part of me. It is not me. And so for sure. I think sometimes that can also become a part of somebody's identity and almost mm-hmm. take over a bit, which for obviously, sure. you know, it's everybody's choice as to how much that is of them. But like you yes. said, which I think is so important, there's so many other aspects of you, and getting yep. bogged down in any diagnosis, I think, can be a negative.
Yeah, for sure. Because, you know, as well, like, yes, okay, I have a diagnosis of ADHD, but I also can concentrate. I also, you know, I'm able to work. I also, you know, I'm able to do a lot of the things that symptomatically I struggle with, you know? And like, sometimes I think, you know, particularly with kind of like internet culture now, it's like, you know, these labels are for building resilience and building capacity rather than like, well, I deal with X, Y, and Z, and therefore I'm going to avoid triggers. I'm going to avoid things that keep me out of my comfort zone. I'm going to avoid things that make me feel uncomfortable. And like, I guess, I suppose I speak like that because that was me for a long time, you know? And I suppose the more I've stepped out of my comfort zone and the more I've challenged those assumptions I had about myself, like the more I found out actually I'm much more capable than I gave myself credit for, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And I think I saw a meme or post on Facebook or Instagram, sorry, and it was said something like, the discomfort starts when you step outside of your comfort zone, and yes. that can feel really uncomfortable, but that's where growth happens. So, yeah. you know, you can stay stuck forever, but you're not going to kind of, you know, grow and experience yep. different things. I wanted to ask you as well, because you briefly mentioned it when you were talking about your experience, but with the binge eating disorder, and then you mentioned yep. you've now been sober for, I think you said mm-hmm. nearly 5 years, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. Were they related? Or were they, like, was there an overlap between the
things? That's funny you should mention. Yes. so I suppose... I did, like, you know, I use drugs recreationally a lot. Like, I did party drugs and stuff like that. But I suppose, you know, for a large part of my life, I was smoking weed every day. And, you know, for like years at a time. And my binge eating and my cannabis use got just like really entwined, you know, because I would be smoking all day. And then, of course, the appetite would increase. And then I'd just be like eating and I'd just like smoke more and then eat more and then smoke more and then eat more. And it became very, very problematic. And I knew that to gain any sort of consistency with my eating disorder recovery, I knew I had to get sober. And because for me, although, like, you know, I am sober, and I, you know, I that is part of my lived experience. Like, for me, I think it wasn't kind of necessarily like the root of things. I knew that I have to get sober because it was almost like I was trying to work on a desk that was just like really cluttered. And then when I sort of allowed myself to have sobriety and be able to have a clear mind and not, you know, have that added pressure, that I was able to, okay, I've cleared the desk now. Now I can start actually working on the things I need to work on, you know?
Yeah, that's such a good thing. I think that's often, I think something that we miss out on maybe is looking at the bigger picture of life in terms of, like, you know, we're so focused on eating disorder recovery and almost the food element of it that we don't think about, you know, the wider concept of life and the things that could potentially be triggering us and the things that we need to work on. And, you know, I'm such a big advocate for sometimes actually, you know, if you're in a position where you're medically stable, sometimes the food actually does need to wait a little bit so that you can resolve, you know, maybe it's the sobriety, maybe it's anxiety, you know, who knows what it might be, so that then you can work on the eating disorder and kind of work on that properly.
Yeah, 100%, because, you know, like I try to tell the people I support, you know, like, for me, it's been a long journey, you know, like I'm almost 5 years sober now, but I previously to that, I had almost a year and a half of sobriety that, you know, and then kind of fell off the wagon again. And, you know, it's been, you know, the guts of, I guess, 12 years of this, you know, of trial and error and, you know, lots of moving forward and moving back and moving forward and moving back. And I think that that's an element of recovery, particularly, you know, with eating disorders or addiction or whatever, that have a high relapse rate. It can be really hard after, you know, trying different things and feeling like, well, why is this time different? You know, why after so many quote unquote failures is this time, like, how am I going to believe in myself? And I suppose what I try to say to people is, like, I've done 5 hospital admissions, 3 of which in Lowest Bridges, you know, I never let go of that belief that, like, I do not have to live like this. I do not have to live like this. Recovery is absolutely possible. And even though there's loads of times I felt that it wasn't, I don't know, I felt like I cannot keep living like this. You know, I'm so miserable. You know, and the other alternative is so much worse. Like, I might as well live with this discomfort that is, you know, hopefully temporary, rather than this, like, misery that is not, you know?
Yeah. What do you think it was? Do you think that was, like, the poignant moment that meant that this recovery was different? Or do you think, because I can really resonate with that in the terms that I thought, I just got to a point where I thought, I can't do this anymore. But I don't, like, was there something more than that, or was that the same for you?
I think it was a few things. I think, you know, sometimes it certainly wasn't like one aha moment. I think that those are quite rare. You know, it was like the slow, it was really honestly just the culmination of those years. Like, even if, you know, like, say the first time I came to Lowest Bridges, I relapsed almost immediately after I left, you know, but I was still learning to accept that I had eating disorder. And then the next time I came in, you know, I did a little bit better, and then I relapsed, you know, and then I got, you know, and then a while happened, and then COVID happened, and, you know, procuring illicit substances became quite challenging. So I kind of used lockdown as like a self-imposed sort of rehab, you know, and that worked for me. The next year I came to Lois Bridges. And I think as well, you know, for me, it was getting a little bit older, you know, my 30s were knocking on the door, I'm not going to lie. And like that sort of sense of mortality and like, okay, you know, I can't keep avoiding this, you know, of like, you know, I'm not going to be in my 20s forever. Like, how long am I willing to live with this? But also, I think managing expectations of what recovery is really important. I think I had this idea that recovery means I'm going to jump out of bed every single morning and be fulfilled 100% of the time, and there's no suffering whatsoever. But like, no one's life is like that, you know, regardless of mental health struggles, like literally no one's life is like that, you know, and being able to say, no, my life isn't perfect. Like, no, I certainly don't, you know, live totally free of maybe, you know, coping mechanisms that possibly don't serve me super well, but I have a lovely partner. I have a great group of friends. I have a job that I love and I find really fulfilling. I'm for the most part happy, you know, and for me, that's enough, you know?
I think that's such a important thing to remember. And I always think, you know, recovery is so different for everybody.
Yeah.
And like, I always had that expectation of like, oh my God, yeah, if I recover, then it means that every day I'm going to have cake for breakfast and I'm going to have so much food and I'm going to look in the mirror and think, God, you look awesome all the time. And it's just not the case, is it? Like, that's not the reality of recovery. And another thing for me was like, it's actually not about the food. It's about connection and friendship and 100%. Energy levels confidence and things like that. And I hope this doesn't come across the wrong way, but I want to ask it. I think, you know, one thing I often hear from people that are in recovery from binge eating disorder is that it can be quite tricky, because when they say they're in recovery from an eating disorder, you know, people have expectations, as we said before, of what an eating disorder is. So they're like, what do you mean? I wanted to ask, did you experience anything like that? Or maybe even it was kind of internalized. And how did you navigate that in your recovery?
I suppose both, for sure. Like I said, I've been plus size my whole life. And I think it's challenging to accept that, you know, my strive for thinness or my unhappiness with my body is what drives my binging behaviors, right? And the flip side of that is, if I follow a balanced meal plan set out by my dietitian involving foods that I enjoy, foods that are nutrient dense, foods, you know, whatever, and then I do enjoy full movement, you know, hopefully semi-often at least, probably the natural result of that is weight loss, you know? And that's really hard, because that means in a way kind of moving towards a socially acceptable body, but also it's giving that really negative self-talk voice in my head what it wants. And and for me, what I find is when I am doing better or sort of following a meal plan in a way that I enjoy, my restrictive thoughts go through the roof. And then in the past, I've like overdone it, and then that always leads to binging, and then I'm back at square one, you know? And I mean, also just in terms of like, you know, I've like, particularly when I first got diagnosed, like I've told friends that I had a binge eating disorder, and they would kind of be like, that's not a thing, you know? They'd be like, yeah, like anorexic people, like that's a thing, like bulimia and stuff, but like, you know, people go on diets all the time, you know, and that's really hard. That's very invalidating. And I don't say that, you know, because people don't know any better. And I think that, like, yes, the experience of being in a plus size body is different, but like, we're all living under the same crazy ideas about what health is. And, you know, we're all a victim of that. And I try not to hold people like to the fire with that, because there's just so much misinformation that I was privy to as well. You know, like when I first came into Lowest Bridges, I was like, you know, when I saw my meal plan, I was like, what do you mean three snacks and three meals every single day? I thought I was going to get a break from eating, you know? It's so different to what you expect. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I suppose that is something I still struggle with, you know, that trying not to use weight loss as like a unit of measurement for my recovery, because there's just, there's so much messaging in our society that, you know, if a sort of socially perceived person who is fat and loses weight, that like their life will be better, their relationships will be better, they'll do better at work, they'll, you know, all aspects of your life will be better. And that's still for me, even though I work in peer support, I work with people with eating disorders, that's still hard for me not to internalize, you know? Mm. And I suppose what I'm trying to do is look at, you know, my relationship with food, my relationship with my body, you know, and use that hopefully as a unit of measurement for my happiness and my recovery. But it's hard. It's still really hard, yeah. You know?
It is. And I really appreciate you, your honesty there in saying that, you know, even though you work with people with eating disorders and what have you, it's still really difficult to not. And you know, I completely agree with that. I think it's naturally as a society, eating disorder or not, there is an internalized bias that being smaller is better. And so when you're in recovery and you're actually having to go against that, it can feel really unnatural. And I know, even, you know, I'm like very far into my recovery now and, you know, loving life, and there's still bad days, obviously. But like yesterday, for example, I went to watch my friends do the Cambridge Half Marathon, and I was with my friend, and this girl ran past who had a very, very like stereotypical perfect body. Sure. My friend, knowing full well, you know, I've been in recovery and what have you, and was like, oh my god, I want her body. And I was just like, oh, like that's such a challenge. But I think the reason I bring that up is my reflection was, okay, before I would have taken that comment and been like, well, I'm not eating today, or like, I'm gonna go to the gym for hours so that I can But actually what I was able to do was say, oh, like, you know, I feel that's a shame, that rather than being, because this girl was quick, like she was at the front. Like, damn, that girl is quick. We were like, or my friend said, God, I wish I had her body. So I think it's having that perspective, isn't it? Of like, I remember somebody saying to me, if someone raises a comment like that, rather than getting on your soapbox and saying why it's bad and, you know, why it upsets you and all this, that and the other, come alongside them and kind of have the open conversation of, it's really interesting that you think that way, actually. And I wonder where those thoughts came from. And, you know, maybe we can see it from a different perspective. Because I think at the end of the day, eating disorder or not, we're all struggling with body image and stuff. And I'm not saying that, you know, eating disorders aren't valid and that, you know, it's not really difficult, but I think as a society we've got a fixation which is really difficult,
for sure.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about your peer support work as well, which you mentioned at the start. So why did you decide to go into peer support work?
So I suppose the last time I was here, I was in treatment with a guy who I'm still very close with, the RTE, which is like our state broadcaster, and did a documentary called Unspoken about men with eating disorders, and they filmed him before, during and after his admission in Lowest Bridges. And that documentary came out in, I think, of like November 2021. And then as a result of that, Lowest Bridges just started to do a all-male online support group for men with eating disorders. And I just joined that as someone also looking for support, you know. And the psychologist even who worked at Lowest Bridges at the time, after a while asked me to come on as a co-facilitator. And so I was like, yeah, cool. Because she was a woman and felt weird sort of running a all-male ED support group. And then it was her actually who sent me the peer support course in Dublin City University. and was like, there's this thing called peer support. I think you'd be really good at it. And I looked at it and, you know, I was, I suppose, maybe feeling a little bit directionless at the time. And I was like, oh, like this actually sounds like it's right up my street. I like talking. I like talking to people. And, you know, I like, you know, hearing about different people's experiences. And so I applied and got a place and did my placement here at Lewis Bridges. And after I got qualified, they offered me a job. And that was like about a year and a half ago. And I've been working here since. Yeah, I absolutely love peer support. I think it's so invaluable to mental health services in general. You know, like I think I learned so much on that course, just about even like the history of, you know, mental distress and how people have been treated and stuff. And, you know, I think the fact that, you know, it's this sort of seen as really like new progressive idea that we're including people who use mental health services in the design and implementation of programs that, you know, are supposed to help them. It's crazy, you know, like, and there's nothing wrong with being super educated. And I work with psychiatrists and psychologists and dietitians, and, you know, it's great. Like, we all bring great expertise, but like, it's when you're coming from a place of lived experience, it's just a slightly different conversation, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important for the people who use services to have someone to advocate for you and to hear you, to sort of listen without judgment. And not that any of those other people I mentioned aren't advocating and, you know, listening without judgment, but I suppose, you know, there are, you know, a huge part of my job as well is like being in the MDT. And, you know, when, you know, conversations are happening and like decisions are being made about people's care, that there's someone with lived experience in the room to say, well, you know, maybe we can look at it this way, or like, you know, okay, well, I experienced it this way. I imagine they might be feeling this way, or, you know, or even just kind of saying like, you know, okay, like I think we need to step back here and like look at maybe this person needs a little bit more time. Maybe, you know, maybe we need a little bit of empathy, you know, I think is valuable. And the feedback I get from my coworkers is amazing. I'm very lucky to have such a wonderful supportive team. I really feel like I'm like just another member of the team. It's great.
Yeah, I think you gave a really good point. And when you mentioned that you go to you're part of the MTT at the start, yeah. I was like, oh, I really want to pick up on that, because I think that's so crucial.
Yeah.
I did a podcast with Eleanor Wilkinson a few weeks ago, and she was saying that when she was an inpatient, they would kind of say it was a, you know, patient involved meeting, but what that meant was the last minute or so she'd go in and they'd tell her what her treatment is. But she didn't actually get any input on that. And I think that lived experience experts are so good at being almost the advocate for the patient. And, you know, I completely understand, and I'm not trying to bash clinicians or healthcare providers at all.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of my issues with diagnoses sometimes, is that we can see the diagnosis rather than the individual. And as you said there, you know, in an MDT, it might be thinking about, well, you know, is this treatment actually working for this individual? Is it right for them? Are we working on the right thing in this moment? Do they need a bit more time? And I think that sometimes clinicians are so focused on getting the person better, and, you know, they have the evidence-informed treatments and everything. We sometimes do just need to take a step back and think about the individual and their life and how this is kind of getting in there as well. So I think it's fantastic to have the lived experience, almost as you're almost like a bridge between the clinicians and the patient, because you understand the terminology and the language that the clinicians and the reasons why they're doing certain things. You can also resonate with the patients and kind of
I mean, I like to think I've like one foot in and one foot out. I'm like somewhere in between a clinician, and because, you know, I guess like and I think that is super valuable as well, like, you know, what you were saying, even in terms of, I think often in eating disorder treatment, the focus is this person doing behaviors or not, you know, as opposed to like, mm-hmm. are they happy? Like, what's, you know, what's the overarching picture here? As opposed to just sort of like symptom management, you know? But again, you know, I really do have to say, like, I work with such an incredible team. I'm like, you know, the work we do here is really valuable. And I'm very lucky. I suppose what I'm saying is there are a lot of lived experience experts and peer support workers who possibly don't have that same support from the people mm-hmm. that they work with. And I want to say, like, I'm very lucky. I feel very supported, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, maybe what we could do to finish up is to, you know, those things that your team do that make you feel, you know, listened to and very mm-hmm. lucky to be in the team. If somebody is listening and think, okay, we have like a lived experience expert, or we, you know, we have peer support, but we maybe don't include them as much as we should do, what could mm-hmm. people do to kind of increase the benefit?
I think one, to not use peer support as a checkbox, for sure. I think a lot of peer support can be very tokenistic, and that, you know, you can have as many feedback forms as you like, but if you don't have a service user in the room, it's not really the same thing. And I think just, I suppose, treating me like my expertise are the same as anyone else, you know? And I like, it's not that I think I have any special knowledge or anything. I just, like, have been through it. And, like, that is expertise in itself. And whether that's, like, the service itself or the, or just recovery in general, or, you know, just thinking of things in a way that is less kind of clinical, I think. And also, I guess, just not, I suppose, I am not, medical models and like medical practitioners are not my adversary. You know, I think that there is a lot of sort of people who believe that it's almost like, what you mean, like, peer support, like, you know, literally like the lunatics running the asylum or something, like, that's, you know, but you know, I'm not here to encroach on anyone's expertise. It's just about having that person in the room. Yeah,
you know, it's that collaborative effort of, isn't it, of seeing things from all different 100%. Perspectives rather than just a clinical perspective, and not kind of coming, you know, seeing it from the patient's perspective. So
for sure,
thank you so much. Really enjoyed understanding your experience and how things kind of relate together, and then also learning more about lived experience too.
And also to say thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, I must say. Thanks so much.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.